Number two, welcome. Thank you for coming in today. Thank you for your interest in the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. What we'll do is start out by asking you to give an opening comments, 5 minutes or so, about your background and why you're interested in being a member of the Board of Regents, and then we'll open it up to questions from the council, and we'll end at 10:45.
And just one technical thing. I think I gave everybody one of these, but if you didn't get one, please, you let me know, and I'll make sure you get one by the end.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, yes. I already apologized to the candidate that I'm going to have to leave in about half an hour or so, maybe not quite that long. I certainly will listen to the rest of the interview, but no
Sounds good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sounds good. All right, Ms. Herp, we'll turn it to you.
All right.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Eileen Herr, but I'm known as Eileen Herr, a name that I chose for myself when I was 13 years old, when my family and I became naturalized U.S. citizens. I was born in Laos and came to the United States of America in 1976 as a war refugee, fleeing political persecution from Laos due to my father and the Hmong's involvement with the U.S. secret war in Vietnam. I, along with approximately 100,000 Hmong, came to the United States of America to create a new home and a place of safety and security for us. And I'm very proud to say that in the last 40 years of being in the United States, my family and I have struggled, but we've done, on the most part, very well. And a lot of that is due to my parents' perseverance and hope and dream for the future and their investment in the children. And what I mean by that is that they worked really hard to make sure that we had a place to live, if not food all the time, that we had a place to live, clothes to wear, and that we could attend school every day. So education is very important to me, and it's actually, if I could do anything to improve the educational outcome of Minnesota students, each and every one, then that would be my legacy. And that's actually what's motivating me to seek a position on the Board of Regents. I graduated from Hamline University with a degree in international relations and political science. And as you can see from the early starts of my life, when being so aware of my political identity and my political opinions, that could actually hurt me, created in me an interest to study it and to understand how it motivates people and actually how it could be used for good. And so I've been very active in the political life of the Hmong in Minnesota. So I went to Hamline University with an interest that I wanted to pursue law, and I wanted to pursue how laws were made and how law could create a more just society for each and every person, and particularly for newcomers to America. So after graduating Hamline University, I went to the University of Minnesota Law School, and I have to say that it is because of state aid and federal funded scholarships and program, Pell Grants and loans, that I was able to afford college, university, and then law school. And getting out of all that, at that time, my debt was about $25,000. And to me, that was a lot, particularly when I considered what my parents were bringing in annually was not even that much. It was a big burden to me, but I felt that was something that was my contribution to the family. That if I could get myself to school, I could get myself a job, and that I would make it. And to a large part, I guess I kind of did. So what you need to know about me is that, one, I'm an adventurer. I am never afraid to rush to do things, to love people, to embrace adventure and the unknown. I'm not afraid. I am the first in my family to go to college. I am one of the first Hmong females to graduate and to attend Hamline University. I think I'm the second graduate there. I am one of two Hmong females, first graduates of the University of Minnesota Law School. I am the first Hmong female to earn admittance to the Minnesota State Bar on my first try. I clerked for the Minnesota Supreme Court. I had the great honor and privilege to serve with Justice Tomjanovich and the late Justice Sandra Gudbring, and they taught me so much, gave me so much wisdom, and I love them and their investment in me. And in all of that, I had to master my surrounding and build common bonds with those around me. I had to reach out as well as let others in. I had to influence and be influenced, as I never forgot that I was Hmong, different, and that I had a lot to offer the world. I am a pioneer and a trailblazer. I never wanted to be. I never wanted to be the first. I always thought that I would follow others, but that was not my fate and that was not my destiny. So I had to break down doors and walls and barriers and get in, and in that I had to be very aware of my position and the opportunity that I'd been given, and not to waste that, but to utilize it and to take full advantage, and not to play it safe, but to challenge the status quo, to put forth my opinions and my ideas, and to challenge, and then to work hard to make this a better place. And I realized that whatever I did for myself, but in effect, I also did for my family, my clan, and my community. And whatever I did, I knew that I had the support of my family, my Hmong community. They were watching me to make sure that I succeeded and that I created a path for others to follow. And because of their love, I was able to flourish in my personal and professional endeavors. I've been very fortunate, and you've seen in my resume, that throughout my professional career, I've been given the privilege to serve my community and to work for a greater good. I've led and worked in a variety of organizations in the government, in nonprofit, and philanthropic sectors. As the former executive director of a state agency, Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, I was at the forefront of establishing legislation, policy, and programs to address the needs, the critical needs of Asian and Pacific Islander community in Minnesota. I am well-versed in the legislative process, public policy, and civic engagement, and I have been able to broker and work with so many others to build a dynamic, vibrant, entrepreneurial, and community civically minded and engaged community. As a champion of community's voice in civic engagement, I've been a staunch advocate for the nonprofit sector and its vital role in empowering and growing leadership in ethnic and underserved communities. I have founded several nonprofits, Allies for Mentoring Asian Youth, Nuchia Hmong Women Achieving Together, and the Heritage Center for Asian American Pacific Islanders, which is all about celebrating the cultural heritage of Asian American Pacific Islanders in Minnesota. I've served on the board of the Minneapolis Foundation, the Minnesota Women's Foundation, various nonprofits that I'm very proud of. And today, again, I'm putting myself out there to take on a new opportunity and to have new goals. That is to be the first Hmong person on the University of Minnesota Board of Regents. As an alumna, it holds a solid place in my heart and in my life. It is the place that trained and put me on to my career path. It is the choice university of vast numbers of Hmong students, and it is the place that can shape, influence, and unlock their potential and talents, as it did for me. The Board of Regents has a critical role to play in addressing the issues that are confronting the University of Minnesota and the state as a whole, in creating policies, prioritize spending and resources, and providing vision for staff, faculty, students, and the community. I believe that the board must and create the university that we need for the society and the economy that we want. And I'm excited and thrilled at the prospect that I may be a part of this great work. Thank you, and I welcome your questions.
Thank you very much. I'm going to start off with the first question, which is about the University of Minnesota's land-grant mission. The University of Minnesota is Minnesota's land-grant university. What does that mean to you, and what do you think that should mean to Minnesota, the people of Minnesota?
Sure. I wrote my personal statement before I truly read the mission, and I was surprised at how my own personal story reflects the mission And I was like, wow, if I read the mission first, my personal statement would have been so much easier to write. No, it is truly my belief that enriching understanding, that it is through understanding everything that we become better people and a better society for that. And so the dedication of the university's mission to research and discovery, to teaching and learning, and to outreach and public service, these are things that I embrace. These are the things that I embrace and that I love and that I actually want to do. One, research. When I was at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, to get anything, you had to prove facts. Hmong people have PS, post-traumatic stress disorder, because of the war experience. No one believed that. No one believed, there's just so much alcoholism. There's just so much domestic violence. Why? Well, what was the root of all of that? It was the traumatic experience of coming to America. It was witnessing war and never talking about it, never having dealt with it. And so when I had the privilege of being at the state to work with the social workers of the states of Minnesota and legislators and created a pathway for social workers of color to get a license as an alternative route of versus just taking the test, but looking at life experience, looking at their work experience and their training as a way of certifying them to be in positions to help communities. So I think, and I'm very excited at the prospect of being at the university and looking at what's the research that's being done, what research is needed. I'm more inclined, because of my background and experience, to look at qualitative as well as qualitative, but experiences, lived stories, and how our research connects and can be practiced in real life. Those are very, you know, very important things to consider for me.
Additional questions? Councilmember Farrell.
Thank you for your opening statement. I very much enjoyed hearing what you had to tell us. One of the things on the Board of Regents that is important to us is diversity, and sometimes age diversity and where people are in their careers is a part of that. Talking to Board to Regent members, there's a big time commitment to being on the Board of Regents, and I see that you are the CEO of your organization. Bravo. How does that match for you with what will be a member of the Board of Regents and your responsibility to the Hmong Center's Elder Center?
Thank you. Thank you so much for your question. I think for myself that if, for me, anything that I take on, I give my full commitment to. And so I answer that question for myself before applying. Can I make the commitment? Do I have the time? And the answer is yes, I do have the time. And the great thing about being CEO is that I'm in charge of my own schedule. And great for me is that I have raised a really great staff that, not that they can do the work without the supervision, because we have goals, we have procedures in place, and we have tactics in place for them to follow. So that is not an issue for me. I do think about the time commitment of what it would take, and so that's a learning curve that I'll take a cue from all of you. I may want to sit on every committee, and you may need to say, no, you cannot. You don't want to kill yourself or burn out within your first year. So I think I'm going to really try to learn from the members of the Board of Regents, pace myself, try to understand the work, and then fully engage myself. So thank you for your question.
Councilmember Moore.
Thank you, Chairman. And thank you, Eileen, for your time today. Can you walk us through your decision-making process when multiple stakeholders are impacted? and how you go about making choices.
Sure. I think it is very important and valid to get opinions from everyone and to validate the people. In my work with the community, and in particularly working on pieces of legislation, it's important that all the stakeholders are called and asked to the table. A lot of times hurt feelings happen because they were never invited to express their opinion. But also looking strategically, long-term, what are the results that we want? And getting the opinions and getting building a coalition and making sure that people feel valued and people feel heard. But at the end of the time, that there is respect, mutual respect. And I always say, in order to solve a problem, there are many, many steps. Let's try this step first, and then we'll try another step. And let's bring in two people, and then we'll bring in three people, and then we'll bring in everybody. And some we won't win over, but that's okay. As long as they can respect me, they can respect the process, they respect the choices, and at the end of the day, that while we have differences and we disagreed on this one particular issue, there are other issues that we can work on, that we can build partnership. And so when I work with adversaries, I never consider them adversaries. They're my friends, and we disagree today. But tomorrow, I will need them again, because this life is circular. I just never talk to person A, I fight with them, they win, I go away. Or I win, they go away. It's not a win-lose situation for me. It's always about connection and triumphing. And taking steps and making headways. And then knowing that we have to have the common respect, because 5 years, 2 months, next week, I may need that person again, or that person may need me. And we have to have that mutual respect and mutual understanding that we need each other. So thank you so much for your question.
Vice Chair Taylor.
Thank you again for being with us this morning. I'd like to learn a little bit more about, if you will, the business model of your current Hmong Elders Center Incorporated.
Thank you, Mr. Moore, for your question. Yes, I am the executive, CEO, it's still hard to say that, of a family-owned business. My family started it about 12 years ago, and it's an adult day center. So we serve about 82 Hmong elders that are 65 years and over, and they come to our center from 9 to 3, and we provide care for them. So and structured programs, and meals for them, and social engagement and activities for elders, so that they are not isolated, so that they are not disconnected from community. And it has been my pleasure to work there, to serve the elders who have lived such great and moving lives. And now it's a chance for them to just kind of relax and not fight so much for struggle and survival, but to say, let's talk about Hmong art. Let's talk about Hmong folk tales. Share with me what you know. And a lot of times for them is, wow, no one's really asked me to tell the story of coming to America. So I've actually engaged them with a couple of oral history projects. They were involved with Theater Mu, The Immigrant Journey, the play that they did last year, and the elders told their story in Hmong, and then actors and actresses played out their story. And that actually was very, worked very well, and was very productive, because the elders felt like they could still engage and participate, but that people understood them. So it was multidisciplinary. So the business model is, we are for profit. We bill the medical insurance companies, and most of them get, most of the funding comes through Medicare, Medicaid, and all the elders that I serve are actually poor seniors that would qualify to be in a nursing home, but they chose not to be in a nursing home because they want to be with the community. And it's actually a very, very, actually want more people to participate in that, because I think it's a great alternative for elders that don't want to be in a nursing home, that want to be independent, that want to stay in the family, want to stay in the community, still be connected to the cultural and family roots. So thank you for your question.
Next question from Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hurd, thank you for applying, and thank you for sharing your story. It's remarkable. Thank you. Just want to ask maybe a two-part question. What do you see as the role between the University of Minnesota and University of Minnesota and the legislature? And then as a regent, what do you see as the responsibility or your role going forward, relationship with legislators or the administration?
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Senator Anderson, for your question. I had many years working with the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and so sitting here is actually very familiar, and this place fills me with, when I was walking, I have not been here in 5 years since I've become the CEO of the Hmong Elder Center, but before that, I spent 4 years working for the State Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and every single session I came here, because I was working on bills, working on legislation, and today, walking here, I thought, oh my goodness, this place, I love it, and I also hate it. It was full of legislative triumphs and also legislative setbacks and failure. But I think that the University of Minnesota and the legislature need each other. In that the legislature funds the University of Minnesota, and it's a public institution. And there's a responsibility and accountability from the university to the state legislature, and the university in terms of asking for. So in my times here, looking at the budgets, funding the budgets, funding the programs, funding the priorities, funding the infrastructure of the University of Minnesota, have to be worked through the legislature for that funding. So there's mutual connection between the two. And what the board region has to do is make sure that we spent the money that we've been given wisely, that we actually live up to our creation from within the Minnesota Constitution, that we are wise servants of our responsibilities in terms of using the money wisely, in terms of making sure that we produce, that we say what we're, that we do what we're going to say. That we do what we say that we will do, and that we are strategic, and that we are accountable. So I will have to learn from the Board of Regents as to how active they are with regards to educating legislators, whether that's a staff position, staff duty, or board members are asked to do that. I am, from my background, I'm more than happy to do that if that is called on, or I can defer to staff. I don't really know how that is played out, but I'm willing to learn and willing to do, and willing to knock on doors and coming to meet with you and talk to you about the needs of the university.
Thank you. Next question is Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Hurd, thank you for being with us this morning. My question is, what do you see as one or two of the significant challenges that are facing the university, and how might you identify some strategies to address those?
Thank you so much for your question. I kind of wrote about that in my application, and of course everyone is talking about just the cost of tuition, making it affordable. I think for me, my number one priority, should I be a regent, would be really to focus on student achievement. And that students are, if we don't get the students, we don't retain the students, and the students don't go out there and don't work and participate in society. To me, that I would consider that a failure. So the first investment is in the students, making sure that we recruit the best and that we unlock their potential. And being so excited at every single student that chooses the University of Minnesota and making it the best place for them to be. Making it affordable. To me, it would be a waste if we don't get quality students because they can't afford the university, that we lose out on that brilliance and that talent. And so there has to be a balance between affordability and bills that have to be paid, the reality of running that. And so some places are looking at tuition-free universities. I'm thinking, and just throwing it out there, but thinking, what about looking at the society that we want? What are the majors and the skills that we so need and lack? And how do we incentivize and get students into those programs? So maybe not tuition free for all, but tuition free for the places, for the minds that we need. And looking at private, looking at public resources, looking and being creative in how we make college, postgraduate, affordable, so that we do get the best and the brightest in the state of Minnesota. So that would be an interest for me, and that would be something that I would be very curious to work on. And then making the environment safe for all students. I think it's really in the news and in the media about sexual assaults that are happening at universities and campuses, and where students should feel free and safe so that they can then just learn and that they can be the best that they can be. Those would be two areas that I'd be really interested in creating strategies and vision for. So thank you for your question.
Next question is Councilmember Hipsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Herr, thank you so much for being here today. The process to become a region is fairly arduous. This what you're seeing here today is just one of the first steps in that process. And from here, it goes on to the legislature. And I know you mentioned in not having had a chance to be in the building much in the last 5 years, but the candidates who've been real successful in the past and getting chosen for a regent, you know, it almost becomes a at least part-time, if not full-time job, trying to get out to talk to as many legislators as you can over the course of the next 2 months, with the ultimate goal of getting the majority of 201 to choose you to sit on the Board of Regents. Can you talk through how you might go about reaching out and connecting with legislators should we move you on from this process?
Thank you so much for your question and bringing reality to me. Yes, it is a process that I kind of dread. That's why I left the council, but also welcome at the same time. The legislative process is something that I'm very familiar with, and I'm not afraid to go again and knock on doors and the political process, very versed in. And to have anyone believe in you, you have to meet people and you have to talk to people. And so I'm not afraid to do that. And any advice and input that people can give me, I'm more than happy to take. The great thing is that in the time when I was with the legislature, and then since then, just working to get candidates of color elected to the Minnesota legislature and the House and the Senate, I've built bonds, ties, and connection with incoming legislators, legislators that are here within my own districts. I've made friends and connection with them, and I'm not afraid to ask for them to champion me, to open doors, and to go and to present my story and my case. And to say that I am the best candidate and that I am a qualified candidate and that I will do my best for the University of Minnesota. Thank you.
Next is Councilmember Menon.
All right, thank you for being here, Ms. Hur. I think you touched on a few aspects of what I'm about to ask you and a couple of your previous questions, but I more specifically want to ask you about what you think are the most important aspects to crisis management, because on the Board of Regents, that'll, of course, be a huge aspect of your role. We've dealt with a number of crises at the University of Minnesota in the last couple of years. So what do you think are the most important aspects to crisis management?
Thank you for your question. I think crisis management, effective way to deal with that is that you have to have a chain of command. You have to have a plan already in place, and we have to respect each other. And so, in my experience, people are designated as the spokespeople, usually the chair, and then someone else if the chair doesn't feel comfortable, or maybe it's a larger institution, so we have a communications director. For staff, the chancellor. So there is a chain of command and a respect for that chain of command, and a no comment when there is no comment. And then the leadership. Usually there is an executive committee that deals with the day-to-day, that deals with when emergency comes, and you have to trust each other. You have to trust that the leadership that you have chosen we'll make the right decision. You don't second guess. When we make a decision as a group, it's the decision of the group. I'm not going to go back and say, this person made a crazy decision and I don't like it. But no, the board made the decision. It's my decision. We talked about it, and that's how we're going to go forward. So just support of one another. And yes, crisis will come up all the time. But if you don't have a chain of command, and you don't have people responsible already in place when that happens, then that's when, or when there's no mutual respect for the leadership, the people that you've chosen to represent you or your institution, and then we go around backstabbing, talking to the media, talking to people, or creating our own, or giving our own solutions without talking and respecting each other first. I think that's when the crisis becomes more than a crisis and becomes a huge hurricane. So, in my mind, set the policy in place, enforce the policy, follow the policy, and then we should be good to go. And totally trust your chair and your chancellor. Thank you.
Councilmember Carlson.
Yes. Good to see you. One of your references said that when you served as executive director of the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesota for over a decade, you rarely asked for a raise. And they said when you finished your position, you were the most senior of anyone in the country and had the lowest salary. I just tee that up because I'm going to ask you a question. If you had served on the Board of Regents this fall, and this is the question. One of the regents suggested that the Board of Regents resist paying the new president what comparable institutions were, actually cited a salary of $300,000 to $400,000, which would be the lowest in the Big Ten, one of the lowest salaries in the country for a major university. What would you have articulated about that topic if you were sitting on the Board of Regents?
Thank you for your question. And for warning me, and I look forward. I was wondering when you were going to ask your question, so I look forward. So thank you.
No, now tell her why, Kathy.
I said that Margaret asked great questions.
Thank you, Kathy.
So thank you for that. Yes. I should let you all know what motivates me is not money. It took me a long time to find out what is my happy place. And for me, my happy place is to serve others for the greater good. That's what actually motivates me and drives me. And that makes me happy. And when I work with students, if money makes you happy, then work towards that. So you have, because if you want money, but money doesn't make you happy and you don't know what makes you happy, then even if you have all of it, you're not still not going to be happy. So for me, when I was at the council, I was very, very aware. And as the state legislators know, during the time that I was at the state council, we were, as a state, almost negative revenues in terms of bringing in tax dollars. So we were always such a challenge. It was cutting all the time. And I wanted to serve my people. I wanted to serve Asian Pacific Minnesotans and the state of Minnesota. And I never asked. I actually took a pay. I never asked for a raise because I knew what my budget was. The reality is, here's my budget. What is the maximum that I can do with it? I didn't want to be poor. I wanted to pay my debt. But at the same time, what was it? Looking at what other people were made, yes, other people probably most likely were making more than me, but that didn't motivate me. What was I doing for the community? What was I using this public dollar for? And is it going to the people of Minnesota? So for me, what was important is that it was going to the students. Now, looking at the salary for the new chancellor, yes, if we want to be recognized as one of the top places to bring in talent, we have to pay that talent. And we have to work really, really hard to make sure that we are funded at the level that we can pay those top talents and that they will stay and that they will feel good. So a lot of times, even now, when I'm at my current position, because it's a family-owned business, if I'm not bringing in the revenue, I'm going to take a pay cut. I pay my staff first. I make sure that my program participants get what they need first. And if that means that this year I'm negative, what my ideal salary is, that's for me personally and how I manage my budget and how I manage my business. That might not be for other people, and that's up to them. But for me, I want to retain my talent. I want to pay my staff what they're worth and what will keep them, what will make them happy. But at the same time, being able to afford all the things that are needed at the university to make sure that we are quality, to make sure that we are great, to make sure that our students get the desk and the safe buildings so that they can learn and flourish. So it is a balancing act, but at the same time, you get what you pay for. If you want that top talent, you have to make the sacrifices to get that. Now, when the top talent is there, they have to work really hard to make sure that they do, in fact, earn their salary. So then it will be up to the new chancellor. Is she going to be worth it? Can she produce? And was the board correct when they made that investment in her? It's something that she has to take up and the board to keep her accountable for. So thank you for your question, and
thank you.
And I can take another one from you too.
that's the spirit.
Councilmember Rogers.
Thank you. I want to ask a more specific question having to do with the university's health sciences. By the way, I might add, you, not specifically you, but your people in a part of the world you came from changed our medical education, I gotta say, for the better, going back 30, 40 years ago. That's when I was there.
Yes, thank you.
But anyway, the health sciences is a significant portion of the university budget. Mm-hmm. The medical school produces 80% of the practicing physicians for this state. And the standing of a medical school amongst the other schools in this country and in the world has actually decreased over the last 20 years. And I'd like to hear your comments about how do you approach this to improve the standing of something as a significant part of the university as it is.
Yes. Thank you so much for your question. We often joked when I was at the council and working here in this Capitol complex that the only two places that were growing when we were having budget deficit was the Mayo Clinic and the DOT. The budgets always seemed to me was always increased, while everything else was cut. And the reality is that we will always need infrastructure, but healthcare is the way of the future. That's where the jobs are going to be, and the service industry. So while we may have robots to produce cars, do a lot of labors, the healthcare industry is only going to grow, and it's only going to flourish, particularly with aging population, and as people live longer, as my current client population is right now. It's just a growing industry, and the state of Minnesota has to be on top of that, and the university. We have to be creative in how we deliver healthcare effectively, affordably, and looking at all the alternatives. In terms of how we diagnose, how we cure, how we teach, and how we train. And I think we, the university, and I'm very proud of the medical services at the university. I know many, many people that have benefited from the services there. So, and to say that we train so many medical physicians, so that's a legacy, and that's something to be proud of, to make sure that we invest in that and that we are at the top of the solutions, that we are at the top of the research, that we are at the top of the creating cures and finding results. I think that's an investment worth making. Thank you.
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our questions. We'll turn it back to you for any additional comments or closing statement that you'd like to make.
Well, I just spent all my time on my opening statement. No, but I hope that through this conversation that you got a little insight into my personality, into my background and my qualification, and my desire. And as to why I want to serve on the Board of Regents, I really do believe that I can make a difference. I really do believe that if I don't have the answers, that I'm on the quest for answers. And it would be my privilege and my honor to serve the university and the great state of Minnesota in this particular way. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your questions. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time today.